CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, and we're going to start with some music. And this song definitely has a very environmental theme, in keeping with our show's theme, which is the environment. This is Men in Helicopters by Adrian Belew from his album Side 3, which was an album that came out in 2006, but this is really a reworked song from an older album. Men in Helicopters is really a very strong statement about the human destruction of the natural environment. One of the lines in the song is quite heavy. It's, "Wouldn't it be poetry to shoot holes in the poachers we see with an elephant gun?" So it's quite an intense song. When you listen to the whole song, it's a great statement. So here is Men in Helicopters version 4.0 by Adrian Belew.
Oh,
And that was Adrian Belew with the tune Men in Helicopters, which there are several versions of by Adrian Belew himself, and that was the one called Men in Helicopters version 4.0. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young, and we're going to start off today's show with an interview that I recently did with Jody Couture. And Jody Couture is an artist. She's a community forest ranger, and she is also a naturalist. And I'm a naturalist, and of course, you know, I like to feature on this show other naturalists. And what is a naturalist? Well, if we look at the dictionary, we see that the definition of a naturalist is an expert in or student of natural history. And the synonyms, of course, are natural historian, life scientist, wildlife expert. And of course, some people use the term amateur naturalist because it's something that they don't do as their profession and they weren't necessarily trained in it in an institution. In my own case, I am self-taught as a naturalist, but I do not consider myself an amateur naturalist. I do consider myself just a naturalist. And what are some famous naturalists? Charles Darwin, David Attenborough, Kate Humble. One of my favorite naturalists was actually one of the original producers of The Nature of Things, and his name was John Livingston. So we're going to feature an interview with a naturalist named Jody Couture, but of course she's not just a naturalist, she's also an artist. She did her fine arts degree at Concordia University, and there she also was the president of the Concordia Outdoors Club. And we're going to be talking to her a bit about that experience. And finally, her work with an organization called One Tree Planted. So here now is my interview with Jody Couture. This is Ryan Young with Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I am here with Jody Couture, who is a naturalist, an artist, and a community forest ranger. And she works with the organization One Tree Planted. And we're here actually doing a physically distanced interview in her backyard in LaSalle.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ryan.
My pleasure. So I wanted to talk about a number of things, sure. But of course, it's not every day that you meet another naturalist. I'm a naturalist.
Yeah.
And I find, especially during the pandemic, there's more interest in nature and in exploring nature. People are forced to kind of just explore their local area more.
Sure.
Sometimes it's just all they can do is visit their local park and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But of course, you've been interested in this stuff for much longer.
Yeah.
Tell me where it started as a kid.
Wow. Oh my gosh, it's hard to even know where to start. It feels like it was just part of my life always. But I would say that my mother really instilled that love in me. She did a range of things with wildlife and domestic animals too. So she was an animal control officer in the town of Bader Fay, which was the town right next to mine. I grew up in Beaconsfield. And I was lucky enough to go on all of her calls with her. So we would, you know, get raccoons out of people's attics in humane ways. We would go after loose dogs. We would do a range of things. And it gave me the opportunity to have hands-on experiences with all kinds of urban wildlife, and I loved it. And on top of that, my parents were both always just very much interested in nature and getting outside, and it just always seemed that wildlife was at the kind of forefront of that. You know, when we were driving, we made a game out of spotting wildlife and identifying wildlife, and a lot of the trips that we took were kind of based around what wildlife we would see. We would go to Algonquin Park all the time because there was so much to see there. It was just very much instilled in my family. Wildlife was just a huge part of that and has followed me and evolved with me through the years.
Nice. And you had animals in the home too, right?
Yeah, so a lot of animals in the home. We did do some wildlife rehabilitation with some urban wildlife, usually baby squirrels, rabbits a couple times. And that was just, we would just kind of do that rehabilitation to get them going to another place, a proper rehabilitation center. But yeah, it gave me an opportunity again for hands-on experiences with those animals. And then additionally, we always had tons of pets. We always had a family dog. We rescued birds. And then eventually my mother and I actually started a guinea pig rescue called Jody's Jiggly Piggly Rescue Farm. And we ended up being a pretty well-known rodent rescue in Montreal, and one of the only guinea pig rescues in the world, actually. And we saved thousands of guinea pigs. And the rescue ran on for over 15 years. So yeah.
And it's no more now?
No. So as I became an older teenager, I drifted away from that a little bit, naturally, you know, with my studies and my own interests. And my mom really took that over. But she's getting closer to retirement age as well and wanted to pursue some other interests. She's always been very passionate about dogs. So she's working closely now with Rosie's Animal Adoption. Just pursuing some other interests now.
Nice, yeah. Nice. So, and then, of course, you studied art in university, but you were also very involved in the Concordia Outdoor Club,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah, that was great. So I did study fine arts. Actually started my university experience with creative writing and sustainability studies. Just wasn't feeling that it was the right match for me. I really like to do things with my hands, and just sitting down in the classroom all day was a little bit challenging. So I switched over to fine arts, and it was a lot more physicality to it, which I loved, and the tactileness of working on a canvas or painting and drawing, and I really honed my art skills. And then on the side, I got involved with the Concordia Outdoors Club. I started just with a VP position, so a vice president position, and I loved it. And then I moved on to become the president, and it was just an awesome experience. We had the chance to bring usually up to 50 students per each trip out of the city and into different nature parks in Quebec and outside of Montreal. And yeah, it was awesome. A lot of the students were international, so they came here from other countries, and they didn't have the knowledge of where these parks were. They didn't have access to these parks, and they just didn't really know much. A lot of them didn't really know much about going into the wilderness and into nature. So it was really cool. You know, we got to lead them on a bunch of different trips. We had a couple overnight trips, lots of different hikes. I had a great team working with me, and yeah, it was just an awesome experience.
Did you discover any new natural spaces you'd never been to?
I would say working with the Concordia Outdoors Club really, it sparked my interest in parks around Quebec. I had parks around my home and stuff that I'd love to go to, but this really gave me the opportunity to see a lot of green space in the province, and a lot of protected green space too. So yeah, I learned a lot about just different national and provincial parks that are around, even regional parks. And not even just big ones, sometimes just small regional parks or different places where you can, you know, rent a canoe or go out for a little urban hike, or just a bunch of different spaces that are accessible and I wouldn't have known otherwise.
And do you have a favorite natural area in Quebec or in nearby Ontario?
Sure, yeah, that's so hard. Okay, well, in Ontario, I would definitely say Algonquin Park. It's just, I did a season working there too and living there, and I loved it. I've been there a lot with my family. It just kind of holds a special place in my heart. So in Quebec, well, I have a lot of urban areas around my home that I really love to go to, as you know. As far as parks go in Quebec, it's so difficult. Man, there's so many. I really love the Saint-Simeon region. Not one park in particular, but it's just gorgeous over there. I love the Eastern Townships. Yeah, it would be really hard for me to just pick one.
Okay. And then you did do a job out in Banff, right?
Yeah, so I worked on and off in the outdoor tourism industry for about 5 years. So I started with a season in Tofino, BC. And then the following summer, I did Algonquin. And then a couple summers later, I did Banff. And then some outdoor tourism jobs in the Montreal area in between those years. Banff was my most recent season. I did that in summer of 2019. I started my season at Moraine Lake. So I was working on the docks there and helping tourists get in and out of their canoes. And it was very picturesque, beautiful. There's some drawbacks to working in the tourism industry too. So about halfway through the season, I decided to go to the town of Banff instead, and I worked at the canoe club there, which I actually preferred that more. It was nice to be part of the community, and Moraine Lake's a little isolated, so yeah.
And you must have taken some good hikes in that area and seen some pretty crazy wildlife.
Oh, I saw a lot of wildlife that summer, yeah. Surprisingly, actually, the majority of the wildlife I saw was at the Banff Canoe Club in town. So we're so lucky. We're right on the Bow River, also really picturesque, beautiful. And we would get herds of elk like regularly, and they would swim across the river right in front of us. And they would be with their young, and yeah, just incredible. Bears, lots of black bears. And then I did have an experience hiking where I ran into a grizzly bear with her three cubs, which was pretty wild.
You weren't alone though.
No, I was with two friends, and we ended up catching up to two other women who had been quite ahead of us, but they saw the bears first. So we all went as a group together, hoping that the bears would be gone by then, but they were actually still there. And we were, you know, doing all the things that you're supposed to do, making our presence known, trying to scare them away a little bit. But they were actually luckily completely uninterested in us. They were just eating their berries on the side of the trail, doing their thing. So luckily there was nothing to be too worried about, but it was a crazy experience, definitely.
Wow.
Doesn't happen every day.
Do you find that amongst your friends or people you know, being a naturalist or maybe even a nature nerd,
sure,
is something that is unusual?
Yeah.
And it's sometimes hard to find another friend or person like that?
100%, yeah. Totally. And this has changed as I've gotten older. But I would say for a long time, actually, as a teenager, and then in my early 20s, I found it challenging to find anyone who had similar interests to me. And I was often, it was often kind of the thing that people thought was like cute or whatever, and which is a little condescending, you know, because I think there's value in it. And it would just be like a little bit of a joke amongst my friends, which was fine. But at the end of the day, it's nice to be taken seriously too. But then
I had the exact same experience.
I'm sure. I think anyone who's interested in wildlife or birds does. As I got older, I started working in more jobs that aligned with my interests. One job that I had was at Atmosphere, the outdoor sports store associated with Sports Experts. Yeah, so I had a job at Atmosphere in the West Island, which honestly, the people I met there changed my life, seriously. I just developed some awesome friendships with people who loved nature as much as I did. And that was years ago, and I still go out with them all the time. And then just through the years, doing more things, like the Outdoors Club allowed me to meet a lot of people with similar interests. Yeah, and the jobs I had in the tourism industry too. And yeah, over the years, I guess just naturally doing more things that I cared about, and also just embracing that side of myself more and more, and just not being, I don't think I was ever ashamed of it, but not taking it seriously and owning that, you know, has allowed me to connect with more people who are like-minded in that sense. So yeah, I have, now I would say I have great friends who love that stuff too, but it did take some time. Definitely.
I don't know. I find this that, and I'm older than you, but,
sure,
you know, there's more infrastructure for those kind of interests than there used to be.
Definitely. I think the internet obviously helps a lot with that, social media. Yeah, it's great. I mean, to connect with people immediately too, but also to see that there are other people who have those interests, even if they're far away. You know, when I got Instagram, for instance, I followed so many people who were doing similar things that I was. And yeah, not only does that make you realize, you know, that there are other people with these interests, but super inspiring. I've been so inspired by so many artists and other naturalists that I've followed online. And yeah, I think the internet is a huge hub for that. And even just Facebook events, you know, has allowed me to go to so many different events and connect with people locally that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. So yeah, I think definitely there's more than ever before.
Do you have any authors that inspire you when it comes to this kind of thing, or?
Yeah, okay.
Not necessarily that,
sure,
you're reading now, but in the past.
Sure. Yeah, I got really into outdoor adventure memoirs for a long time. And I would say that really inspired me to do my work in the outdoor tourism industry. Really inspired me to go to other provinces, to wild places. kind of cliche at this point, but the book Wild by Cheryl Strayed was one of the first books I read when I was just getting into that. I was still really young. I'm still young, but I was even younger. And yeah, just found her story so inspiring and really sparked that passion to want to go out there and like do something adventurous and step totally outside of my comfort zone. But just got to throw this in there. My all-time favorite author is Pam Houston. Highly recommend to any, especially women who love the outdoors. She writes kind of semi-fictional memoirs, but you're not really sure if they're memoirs, but she's had a ton of experiences in the outdoors, and she's been a guide for, you know, rafting and hunting and fishing, and she's just done it all. And she also talks about her in a very non-cliche way. She talks about her romantic endeavors in the outdoor tourism industry. And yeah, she's just so unique. And yeah, a little shout out to my friend Julia who introduced me to her, because yeah, her writing is just, yeah, it's just moved me. Like, she's my all-time favorite author now.
Pam Houston.
Yeah, Pam Houston.
Cool.
Yeah. Cowboys are my weakness.
Classic. American author, I guess?
Yeah, she's American. Yeah. I think she lives in Colorado now. She's got a big ranch and tons of animals and just living a life.
Cool, yeah. Cool. And in terms of your art, sometimes these natural spaces gets reflected in your art.
Sure, yeah.
And I've seen these amazing canoe paddles you've mm-hmm. done yeah. where you paint the paddle.
Yeah.
Tell me how you got into that.
Wow, yeah. I mean, I was in art school, so I had to produce a lot of work all the time, and I also take tons of pictures when I go to these places, so just naturally, you know, my interests between art and the environment kind of collided together there. And yeah, I just ended up reflecting, like you said, reflecting a lot of those experiences I had in national parks and different areas, natural spaces, in my art. Yeah, so I would do some more decorative stuff with the paddles. I did do a few works that I wanted to be more focused on environmental issues and habitat loss and issues like that.
And some were commissions, right?
Yeah, I got some commissions too. Did do a few commissions for folks who wanted a decorative piece for their cottage or a gift for a partner or something like that. Because a lot of the stuff I paint is natural and it's pretty, so people like to hang it in their homes. Yeah.
I guess if you use the paddle too much, you would ruin the art piece, right?
Definitely, yeah. Probably not the best. I wouldn't recommend using it once it's painted on.
But how do you paint on a paddle? Like, what type of paint do you use? And then what kind of finishing thing do you put on it?
Yeah, so I have only really painted with acrylic. I've experimented with oils, but it's just, I was often doing these paintings in my home, and there's a lot of chemicals involved with oil painting, and it's just a much bigger process. So I did mainly use acrylic paint. Dries fast, it's easy, it's a little more versatile. I have done a couple paintings like outside before too, or brought my paintings with me, and it's much easier to do that with acrylic paint versus oil. So for the paddles, I would just sand them down, and then I would do the acrylic on top of the paddle. And often I wouldn't put a finish on it. I would just leave it as is, yeah.
So are you still doing art?
Yeah, that's a good question. not as much now. Art school took a little bit of a toll on me, as it does for a lot of art students. It's hard, and yeah, it's a lot. But I still have a practice that what I consider to be a practice. It's just very different from what a lot of people would consider a fine art practice to be. I've gotten a lot more interested in craft. Like I said before, I really like to do things with my hands. I've been doing a lot of work with clay recently. And then I also think that the scavenging that I do and that kind of stuff, drying flowers, and I've been really interested. I just got this great new apartment, and I've been really interested in decorating it in a environmentally sustainable way, and yeah, just making it a really comfortable space. And I kind of consider all of those things that I do that have an element of creativity to be part of my practice. So yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And then now you're working for One Tree Planted.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about that organization and what they do.
Yeah, sure. So we're a 501c3 Canadian nonprofit and American charity, and our focus is on global reforestation. So we have large-scale reforestation projects all over the world. And our model is simple. $1 towards one of these projects will plant one tree. Yeah, and we get donations from individuals as well as businesses, and my role there is actually more focused on a community level. So I'm an event coordinator. And I coordinate employee engagement events. So for businesses who want to get their employees out and do some corporate social responsibility work, they will often choose to do something along these lines. So I will coordinate those events for them. They can be tree planting. Often they are tree planting. People really tend to be drawn to tree planting, but they can be other restoration work too. We've done meadow restoration, invasive species removal, a range of different stuff, trash cleanup. And yeah, we have two community initiatives as well. So one takes place in the fall for Plant a Tree Day, and another one takes place in April for Earth Month. And throughout those months, we will have, before COVID, we would have over 100 events around the world. A lot of them do happen in the States, but we have some globally as well. And those are open to the One Tree Planted community at no cost. And they're really a chance for us to engage our followers and our community, and also support the planting partners that we work with.
Yeah. Cool. Tell me what you like about the job.
Well, there's lots of things. I really enjoy working with the planting partners that we work with. They have often, you know, great projects. I've always been interested in things at a community level. So the job really kind of fits that interest, aligns with my values. So yeah, I enjoy that. It's really rewarding to set up one of those events and get the photos back and hear about how many trees were planted and acres restored and, you know, the impact of those events. The job is also, it's cool, you know, we get a chance to go out to these events, we get a chance to travel, to meet such a diverse range of people who are also doing environmental work, go to conferences. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunities there that are just really rewarding. And also we have an awesome team that I love working with. It's a lot of things.
Nice.
Yeah.
And how has it changed during the pandemic?
So the events, I would say our projects have not changed so much since they're executed by professional tree planters, and a lot of places tree planting was an essential service. So that hasn't changed so much, but I would say, yeah, on the event side of things, there was definitely a learning curve, especially at the beginning. I went from having, you know, over 100 events to coordinate to having pretty much no events to coordinate overnight. So yeah, it was just a learning curve there. We explored, you know, virtual event opportunities, how to engage with people who wanted to give back in a socially distanced way, in a COVID safe way. And slowly things started to pick back up with the events. We did move forward with our Plant a Tree Day initiative in September. So we were able to have, I think it was about 25 events, mostly in the US, some a few internationally and some in Canada as well. And yeah, we just went forward with those in a really COVID safe way, make sure, you know, all regulations were followed. And it's actually a pretty good COVID activity because everyone's outside, there's plenty of space, social distance, make sure everyone wears a mask and all the tools are sanitized. And yeah, slowly things are getting back to a new normal anyway. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, I guess just your own perspective on things, you know, what continues to motivate you to be interested in exploring the worlds of nature while also working in a field to try and help natural
things? Yeah, sure. So, it's a big question.
Yeah.
What motivates me to continue exploring nature? I mean, there's just so much to see, and but I really think it's what motivates me to keep going out there is really just the feeling I get when I'm out there, you know. It's just such a huge part of who I am, my identity, and great for my mental health. I would suggest it to anyone who has ever struggled with mental health issues, or even if they haven't, to just get outside. It's so many benefits. And some things too maybe are less emotional. Like, for instance, I have like a mental list of all the birds that I've seen and all the wildlife that I've seen, and I want that list to keep growing. And I guess I really love the kind of treasure hunt aspect of that, you know. I love scavenging for bones and feathers and different traces of wildlife that's been left behind. And yeah, you just never know what you're going to find, and I find that really exciting. And I just, yeah, I just connect really deeply with wildlife and with the natural world. And then my job allows me to do that too, in a different way, you know. It allows me a chance to get other communities involved, and there's a lot of educational opportunities there, and you know, a lot of policy and stuff or changes that have to be made in terms of the environment happen behind the scenes. So gives me a chance to do some more of that kind of stuff as well. Yeah.
And in terms of One Tree Planted, how they're able to get the donations that are needed to plant the trees, What kind of avenues do they use to try and encourage people to donate?
Sure, yeah. So, well, we have an awesome marketing team and a great video team as well. So we have a lot of awesome videos about the projects that we support that are really engaging. And I think people really connect with that. We're very active on social media. And again, I think that we post a lot of stuff that people connect with and relate to. Yeah, our Orca project, for instance, this takes place on the West Coast, and it focuses on planting trees to rehabilitate salmon habitat, which in turn helps orca whales, as it's like a huge source of food for them. So yeah, I think people really resonate with the projects that we support. A lot of them have community impact as well, and that's really important to people too. Yeah, and we have donors who are, you know, individuals who just see our stories and connect with us online, who just want to give back. And then we also have businesses that want to partner with us. And, you know, a lot of businesses will want to donate, you know, a tree for every sale or something along those lines. We've had some companies, for instance, who will plant a tree for every bag that they give out to customers, stuff like that. So it gives companies a really great opportunity to engage with their customers and with the environment too.
Cool. And who founded the organization?
Our founder is Matt Hill.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Ryan. This was great.
And that was my interview with Jody Couture, a naturalist, artist, and community forest ranger. If you want to find out more about One Tree Planted, you can go to their website, which is onetreeplanted.org. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Now we are going to feature some music from the group Camel. And Camel was an English progressive rock band, so English meaning they were from England, that formed in 1971. And they never really had great success, but they definitely had a committed following of fans. And in 1975, they came out with an album called The Snow Goose. And this song, the title track Snow Goose, is an instrumental. So it's from 1975, and it's great. So have a listen. Thank you. And that was the tune The Snow Goose from 1975 by the English progressive rock group Camel. So now we're going to feature an excerpt from a new podcast. And I think it's a very interesting podcast for people who listen to this show, Ecolibrium, because it's about the environment or environmental issues. And of course, you would know the man behind this podcast, and that is none other than David Suzuki, the famous broadcaster and geneticist and environmentalist, and voted one of the greatest Canadians of all time back when CBC did a poll or a contest that was all around crowning whoever would be considered the greatest Canadian of all. When they had the 10 top people, they did a series of votes, and David Suzuki was number 5. And in fact, he was the only living one in the top 5. And I think there was only one other living person in the top 10 other than him, if I remember correctly. So, of course, David Suzuki, the host of The Nature of Things, which is still a show which is on the airwaves. It's still being broadcast on CBC television. And in fact, this year is their 60th anniversary. So they are the longest running CBC television show of all time. And in fact, I believe it is television's longest running science series of all time. And so David Suzuki, like many of us, is no longer traveling a whole lot, or obviously going to conferences or speaking at conferences or traveling internationally and so on. He's spending a lot of time on one of the islands off of Vancouver Island, where he has a summer home. And so he decided to start a podcast. And I know that David, having interviewed him for this show a number of years ago, when his autobiography came out, that radio was his first love. And in fact, I think he said in the interview that I did with him that radio was his preferred medium, that he loved radio. And so he's now doing his own podcast. And he actually started in radio because before he did The Nature of Things, he did Quirks and Quarks, which is now hosted by Bob McDonald. And so he has quite a bit of history doing radio, and he did various CBC radio series as well. One with my friend Holly Dressel, who's also been on the show before, they did From Naked Ape to Super Species together. So anyways, for his first season of the podcast, which of course he titled COVID-19 and the Basic Elements of Life, and he wanted to use this opportunity of the COVID-19 pandemic to explore how the pandemic can help us refocus on what's most important and what a green and just recovery from COVID-19 could look like. So he did, for the first season, the 5 elements: fire, air, water, earth, and spirit. And there are some great interviews in the series featuring people like the famous actress and activist Jane Fonda, people like Autumn Peltier, Indigenous activist Jeanette Armstrong, famous Canadian singer-songwriter Neil Young, famous Indigenous activist Winona LaDuke, and these are all available for free to listen to. You can go to davidsuzuki.org/podcast, or you can look for the podcast by going on iTunes and downloading it from there. But we're going to feature an excerpt from the last episode of this past season, which happened last year during 2020, because now we're 2021. And this particular episode was the episode about spirit. And of course, David's longtime partner and wife, Tara Cullis, is an award-winning writer and former faculty member of Harvard University. And she has been a key player in environmental movements in the Amazon, Japan, British Columbia. And she, along with David, founded the David Suzuki Foundation. So David decided to interview his own partner and wife, Tara Cullis, about the topic of spirit. And they got into the discussion a little bit about the differences between the left brain and the right brain and the different approaches to knowledge and understanding the world and interacting with the world. And for Tara, she really critiqued the overemphasis on the left brain relationship with the natural world with the earth, and was saying that everything is too focused on the left brain and we need a balance between the right and left. So we pick up her discussion with David right when she's discussing that here.
And so that's when I realize we really do have to balance the left and the right brain. They're both so important. I feel that this great rise in the power of scientific or left brain thinking has led to terrific scientific advances, but it's also simultaneously devastated our ecosystems. And it's driven out a lot of holistic thinking from much of business and industry and government. And remember, in economics, the environment that's our life support system is considered an externality.
Right.
So we've learned to value the world quantitatively in terms of numbers and finances and devalue the whole diverse world of emotion and systems and meaning. And what we've done is we've learned to look at the world as a set of resources and to forget that it is home. And one thing I need to point out is I don't mean to imply that one mode of thinking is superior to the other. My point is that neither is. My point is that we need to use our whole brains, and overvaluing one mode at the expense of the other is thinking with only half a brain. And that's what is dangerous and very destructive.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the really destructive aspect of ignoring the right brain so much is its ability to see the big picture. I think of what we've done here in BC. We have the highest biomass weight of living things in these forests than even the Amazon rainforest. And the reason is we got big trees, but it's a rainforest. It rains a lot. And if you look at the soil, it's depleted in nitrogen. So the big dilemma is, how can we get such big trees when there's so little nitrogen in the soil? And that's something I'm very proud of what David Suzuki Foundation did, supporting Dr. Tom Reimken at the University of Victoria to solve this great mystery. Big trees, no fertilizer in the soil. What Reimken and others have shown is that these big trees get the biggest pulse of nitrogen fertilizer from the ocean through the salmon that return every year. So up and down the coast, billions of salmon are coming back. They're loaded with nitrogen from the ocean, and we can tell the difference between ocean nitrogen and terrestrial or land nitrogen. And what he has shown is if you take a core from a big tree, you get fat rings and narrow rings. So the fat rings have had a big growth in a year. And what he found was that the fat rings have a high amount of nitrogen that has come from the ocean. And when you have a skinny ring, there isn't as much nitrogen. So he had a direct relationship between runs of salmon and how well the tree did. He followed what happens to those salmon. And a bear, on average, will take about 600 salmon out of the river. They're usually salmon that have already spawned. And they'll fish together around a big pool, but they don't like to eat with other bears around. They run off into the forest. So they can go up to 150 meters to the side of the river, and they eat the brains and the belly and the eggs, and they dump the rest on the floor. And then, of course, you know, the ravens and the slugs and the beetles and everything is eating what's left there, and they're pooping in the forest and they're fertilizing the trees. And the carcass, usually after 3 or 4 days, is covered with maggots. The flies lay eggs and the maggots are eating the flesh, and then they drop to the floor of the forest. And over winter now, they're loaded with nitrogen from the ocean. And the next spring, when trillions of flies emerge out of the ground, it's exactly the time when the birds from South America are coming through on their way to the Arctic.
God.
So this unbelievable system. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of the salmon die and they sink to the bottom. of the river or the stream. And within a few days, they're covered with a coat of fungus, and the fungus is eaten by bacteria and copepods and insects. And when the baby salmon come out of the gravel, you know, three or four months later, the river is filled with food for the babies that have come from the carcasses of the dead mothers and fathers. So in dying, they prepare a banquet for their kids to get them off on their route to the ocean. So this is this brilliant, wonderful system that's all a part of a single entity. What we do when we come along now, the government's come, the salmon. Well, the Minister of Commerce, he deals with the commercial fishing fleet. But then there are a lot of sport fishers. That's the Department of Tourism. So you've already divided the salmon up into completely different departments that are often going to be fighting each other. And then we say, oh, well, the trees, that's the Minister of forests, and the river, that's the Minister of Energy or the Minister of Agriculture. And of course, you've got the eagles and the bears. That's the Department of the Environment. So what is a single holistic system that the right brain sees instantly? The left brain goes, oh, we're going to manage this through our very, you know. So this is what really brings us into a lot of our crisis today.
How do we get to this overdependence on breaking things down? And actually, the concept of progress really only appeared around the early 1800s. And we came through into the 20th century and got into the 50s, and we saw the glory days of advertising starting to help business to profit by making us want more things. And by that time, Western thinking had pretty well become left brain thinking. And then the 60s hit, which was incredible. I mean, it was an explosion of the right brain against that long left brain creep of the centuries. And no wonder they called it the counterculture. It was amazing then to be young and alive and to protest against the hierarchy and against the dominant linear thinking, which appropriately was called straight. It was an age of rebellion, of marches and demonstration. It was an era of rejection of injustice and a boiling up of noble ideals. And it wasn't just against something, it was supremely creative. It gave birth not just to an explosion of music, as you know, but think about it, to the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the peace movement, and the environmental movement. Mm. But remember, all these movements were, in those days, thoroughly intertwined, and music and art were integral parts. So our field, for example, the environmental movement, was born in the time of civil rights and social justice and pacifism and was steeped in it. That's why Greenpeace got its name, right? Green and peace. Environmental work was born out of a deep link between social justice and all progressive movements. And for the first couple of decades, the modern environmental movement was pretty successful. And we had a lot of great adventures. I mean, that was when we were really following our spirit. We were just, I mean, it might look random historically, but it was so much fun.
We also lucked out, and part of it was because of our environmentalism, but also the filming. You know, meeting the Haida.
But you know what? When I think back, because of the nature of things, because of your television program, that was in the late 70s, yeah, right? And at that point, we weren't environmental. Well, we just, like everybody else,
were worried about pollution.
Yeah, and that kind of thing.
Clear-cut logging.
Yeah, but that show introduced you to the Haida people, which introduced you to Indigenous people in general. And that, I think, is what started our conversion to environmentalism, because after that show, we got involved with the Stein Valley, the Nokomis people in interior British Columbia, fighting for their forest. And then that gradually spread, because the same problems, we realized, holy smokes, are popping up in other parts of the world. So we realized the Ainu of Japan were trying to fight for their salmon and bears because their rivers were being dammed, just like in British Columbia. And then the Panan of Sarawak, you know, same thing. And then the Kaiapo in Brazil. Oh my gosh, there they were trying to stop a huge dam that was going to drown vast territories. not just of the trees, but of all the wildlife that lived in those forests. And so we just had one adventure after another. Once we opened that door to see what was really going on in our own province, and then recognizing those same patterns.
So what have we learned from the COVID-19 lockdown, and what kind of a world do we want to head for after?
Well, that's, I guess, a question everybody's asking. I think for us, we were forced to look back at nature and spend a lot of time in it. And we couldn't help but notice how nature was bouncing back even a little bit in our corner of the world. We saw that the lack of planes up there made a big difference, and that the lack of boats out on the water just roaring up and down and harassing whales and so on wasn't happening, and the whales came back. And I think it just gave people a moment to take a breather and just ask, are our lives proceeding in the ways that we had hoped for, and in the ways that are going to bring us fulfillment and a happy, healthy life in the future? I know a lot of people only felt hardship in this time, and I don't presume to speak for them. People have lost their jobs, people have lost their lives and loved ones. But I think for me and for a number of the people I know, it's brought the sense that one can make the right decisions for oneself in the future, and determination to try to not let that sense slip away. It's a powerful feeling, and it's a good feeling, and it gives us hope. We're always looking for sources of hope, but I think this is quite a big one, and I'm going to take it.
Well, I don't think there's any better way to end this discussion than that. Thank you very much for that. All of our listeners will now know how lucky I am to be married to you. And I think that I'm now going to put every effort I can into getting you elected Prime Minister of Canada.
You can be my campaign manager.
And that was an excerpt of the Spirit episode of the David Suzuki podcast, which came out new in 2020. Be sure to check out the whole podcast and that episode by going to davidsuzuki.org/podcast. And in that episode, there is also a great interview with the Canadian singer-songwriter Neil Young. So that was, as I said, the last episode, which is entitled Spirit, of the David Suzuki podcast, COVID-19 and the Basic Elements of Life, which is produced by the David Suzuki Foundation in partnership with Jason Arkley Productions. Well, that's all the time we have left in the show today. Thanks for listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Ryan Young. You can always follow us by going to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. You can go to our website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. We also have a SoundCloud page. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young and on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. You can also email the show by emailing equilibrium@ckut.ca. So that's equilibrium@ckut.ca. We're going to leave you with some music. There was a great band and really artist that formed in Montreal and was a staple on the Canadian music scene for many years, especially the 1980s, and that was the band Luba, or really the artist's name was Luba, and their very first album was called Chain Reaction, and there's a great tune on that album called Run Around. So here now is the tune Run Around by Luba from 1980.
No. Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in your life? CKUT has new merch, including hoodies and t-shirts, that showcase classic designs dug up from our art attic. Head to ckut.ca to discover our new merch store and find out more about sizing and shipping. Happy holidays from all of us at CKUT.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding at ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
To slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
The spread of the virus. Wear a mask in public places, such as on public transit and in grocery stores and businesses. The best way to protect your health and the health of those around you is still to follow recognized hygiene measures. For example, washing your hands regularly and keeping your distance. Let's continue to protect ourselves. Find out more at quebec.ca/mask. A message from the gouvernement.
So you can stop guessing if this is a gift or a written down memo. See, I am a professional. This is not a demo. In fact, call it a lecture, a visual picture, sort of a poetic and rhythm like mixture. Listen, I'm not dissing, but there's something that you're missing. Maybe you should touch reality. Stop wishing for beats with plenty bass and lyrics set in haste. If meaning doesn't manifest, put it to rest. I am a poet. You try to show it, yet blow it. It takes concentration for fresh communication, observation. That is to see without speaking. Take off your coat, take notes. I am teaching a class, or rather school, because you need schooling. I am not a king or queen. I'm not ruling. This is an introduction to poetry, a small dedication to those that might know of me. They might know of you, and maybe your gang, but one thing.